My name is Russ Belville. I am the host of a show called The Marijuana Agenda, which is a live daily 2-hour talk radio program, news and interviews, data and analysis, all about the cannabis community, all aspects, business, culture, science, history, and health. I'm also a frequent contributor to High Times Magazine and Green State and a bunch of other websites. And I run Portland's best cannabis-friendly Airbnb, a place called Delta 9 House. So much for the lazy stoner stereotype, right? But I'm here today because it's my job to learn and read and research all about cannabis, marijuana, hemp, everything that's going on in this industry. And I've interviewed hundreds of people on this. I've written over 1,000 articles on this. And so today I want to talk about a natural substance that we all love, something that we couldn't imagine living our lives without, something that's plentiful all across this planet, used everywhere in the world, has been known since the dawn of civilization, and has been used by ancient peoples and is still used today for a myriad of purposes. And that substance I'm speaking about, of course, is aluminum. Kind of took a left turn there. Not cannabis, aluminum. I want to talk about aluminum today, and you might be thinking, why the hell do you want to talk about aluminum? And the reason I want to talk about aluminum is because there's a lesson in aluminum. There's a lesson in aluminum for those of us who are in the cannabis industry, those of us who are looking at this green rush, looking at this future of cannabis commerce. And aluminum has a lesson for us. Now, aluminum is the most precious or the most plentiful metal in the Earth's crust. And we've known about it forever. And the ancient Greeks use it, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Persians. They had all sorts of purposes for it. But there was a problem with this substance that they called alum. And the problem is, you couldn't find it in its pure state. Aluminum's not like gold or silver or copper, where you're going to go dig a hole and find a mother load of it in a pure state. Aluminum bonds to so many other materials, so many other types of elements like potassium and sulfur and silica. So while the ancients had used aluminum, they'd never used it in its pure form. They'd always gotten it in some sort of combination. Up until the 1800s, there was no such thing as pure aluminum. It was always in some sort of compound. But as we approach the 19th century, get around 1778, some chemists start coming up with a theory. They start figuring out there is this thing called aluminum, this material called aluminum. We can't really get a pure version of it, but in theory it must exist. But it still didn't exist. Nobody had ever seen pure aluminum. By 1807, there had been the invention of electrolysis, the process of using electricity to be able to separate materials, elements. Some of the materials that got separated were potassium, sodium, calcium, strontium, barium, and magnesium. And those chemists who'd been theorizing about aluminum figured, well, there's got to be a way to get pure aluminum with this same process. But they labored at it, and they couldn't really figure out how to get pure aluminum. Of course, here in America, we call it aluminum. Everywhere else on the planet, they call it aluminium. But same substance that we're talking about here. As time progressed, they kept working on better ways of mining aluminum, better ways of getting aluminum, separating it from the other materials. By 1825, they had managed to put together a few tiny little flakes of aluminum. And it wasn't pure aluminum, it was as close as they could get, but these little tiny flakes. But from that, they were amazed. They're like, wow, this substance, there's something to this. This is some good stuff. By 1845, they had discovered they had made enough aluminum that they could figure out what its properties were, that it was shiny, that it was light, that it was malleable. You could bend it. It was great at distributing heat for cooking, and all these materials, all these properties of aluminum that they'd finally figured out by about 1845. By 1852, there begins a commercial aluminum industry. They start producing aluminum commercially. So in 1852, the commercial price for aluminum was $550 a pound. When you first could get aluminum, it was $550 a pound. Now, once they'd figured out how to make some aluminum commercially, they start producing more and more of it. By 1854, just 2 years later, they'd come up with large-scale production of aluminum. And in 1855, it became the sensation of the Paris World's Fair. They made a few marbles of aluminum. They took them to the Paris World Fair, and people freaked out. They're like, oh my God, this is shiny like silver, but it's light, it's malleable, it's bendable. There's so much we can do with it. It's amazing. They were so amazed by aluminum that Napoleon, Emperor Napoleon, commissioned aluminum plates to be made for his most respected and honored guests. Now, he had gold plates. He put the gold plates aside to give people the aluminum plates because aluminum was so amazing, so rare. So between the 1850s and the 1880s, aluminum was a precious metal. It was like jewelry. It was like silver. But the price had come down a bit. They started figuring out better ways to manufacture it. They got it down from $5.50 a pound down to $20 a pound. Still, that's pretty expensive for what we think of as aluminum, but $20 a pound. And during that 30-year period, you got to imagine there was a whole bunch of people that got into the aluminum business. A whole bunch of people that said, hey, I'll make this metal, I'll make jewelry out of it. They were literally wearing jewelry made of aluminum. So there had to be all sorts of small family jewelers that were making aluminum jewelry and aluminum plates and other sorts of fine aluminum goods. Aluminum was so revered and so wonderful that in 1884, the U.S. government commissioned a 6-pound cap of aluminum to be put on the top of the Washington Monument. And at that time, in 1884, the worldwide production of aluminum was 3.6 tons. Worldwide, that whole year, 3.6 tons of aluminum compared to 2,834 tons of silver. Now, to add to the aluminum story, something was about to break in the late 1800s that would change aluminum forever. It began with the birth of two men, one in Ohio, one in France, both born in the year 1863. The American was a guy by the name of Charles Martin Hall. The American and the Frenchman, simultaneously, not knowing each other, were both chemistry whizzes and came up with these brand new ways to extract aluminum. Revolutionary techniques to extract aluminum. And by 1886, they filed their patents on this new aluminum extraction technique. By 1886, aluminum was down to $6 a pound. Had been $5.50 just 30 years ago. Had been $20 just 20 years ago. Now it's down to $6 a pound in 1886. By the way, Charles Martin Hall later went on in 1907 to found a company called Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America. So, once he starts doing the new extraction method for aluminum, in 1884 they are producing 22 pounds of it a day. By 1888, producing 50 pounds of it a day. By 1891, the price was below $1 a pound. Think of that. The price declined from $6 a pound to less than $1 a pound in just 5 years. By 1903, the price of aluminum was down to 30 cents a pound, which was good because in 1903, the Wright brothers were looking for some way to make a lightweight engine they could use for an airplane that they were building. Had that aluminum not been 30 cents a pound, they never could have afforded to make that engine and engage in the first flight. By 1908, they were producing 88,000 pounds of aluminum per day, up from just 22 pounds in 1884, up from just 50 pounds just 20 years prior. They were up to 88,000 pounds a day by 1908, and the price was down to 25 cents a pound. Today, 2016, latest year, 362.8 million pounds per day were produced of aluminum. The cost is 73 cents a pound, but if you weigh that in 1908 dollars, it's 3 cents a pound. A substance that started artificially scarce at $550 a pound now is down to 3 cents a pound, and they're producing 362 million pounds of it a day. So, why did I tell you all that about aluminum? Because the 2010s for marijuana are like the 1850s for aluminum. If you're planning your next 20 years on a business model that depends on $300 ounces at the retail level and $1,000 pounds at the wholesale level, you're the guy making aluminum jewelry in 1885. Because those prices aren't going to last, and they're going to drop really quick. We've already seen in Washington State, they legalized marijuana in 2012. Their initial retail price was $32 a gram on the average. Today, that retail price average is down to $9 a gram. In Oregon, we have consistently the cheapest prices for marijuana as listed on a website called priceofweed.com. They're listing it as $220 an ounce for high quality ounce. I don't know anybody that's paying $220 an ounce. I know people paying a lot less for that in Oregon. So, if that's where we're at with Oregon, Colorado, Washington, these small states, where do you think we're going to be when California mega grows come online in 2023? When they start putting together those unlimited sized fields of cannabis that they're going to put together, that price is going to decline rapidly. Now, another thing to consider is that currently, cannabis is a Schedule I drug, which means it's federally legal, which means that any major corporation, say an Altria, a Philip Morris, for example, they don't want to get involved in marijuana right now because they can still get their ass pulled into federal court over it. And they got a whole lot of assets outside of cannabis they don't want to risk by going after the cannabis market. But boy, you drop that Schedule I designation, you make a Schedule II or Schedule III, and that's what they want. That's when the big boys come and play, because now they can dominate that market. Think of Schedule II and Schedule III drugs you know today. OxyContin. Anybody know any small family farms putting together OxyContin? Small businesses that are putting together OxyContin these days? No, it's big, big pharmaceutical corporations that are doing this. We've got GW Pharmaceuticals that's already getting its Phase III trials together for its Epidiolex, its CBD oil. We've got Insys Therapeutics, an Arizona company that makes a fentanyl spray, which is an opioid spray, that donated $500,000 in Arizona to defeat that legalization, and then, right after the election, applied for a designation from the FDA to go forward with their own medical marijuana cannabis spray. Eliminate the natural competition, kick in the corporate model. That's what's going on. So it worries me as I examine these trends and I look at the history of this and I think of aluminum and how it changed. And I got to thinking, you know, what if the guys that made aluminum back in the 1800s that were making aluminum jewelry and aluminum plates back in the day figured out that more development of aluminum would hurt their business model? And what if they actively fought against those, that French kid and that American kid who are trying to make a better way to make aluminum just to protect their profits? That's what I worry about right now, because we have sold marijuana legalization on a couple of things. We've said, hey, governments, you can tax it and make money. And we've turned to people and said, hey, entrepreneurs, you can sell it and make money. So if a government has gotten fat on a 20% tax on a $300 ounce, what are they going to do if that ounce drops to 30? If a business has built its business model on selling $1,000 pounds wholesale and that drops to $100 pounds, what are they going to do? Well, some of them will expand and grow and become the big dominant players, but the rest will be like those guys selling aluminum jewelry back in the 1880s who are going to have to find something else to do, unfortunately. And the other way I look at this is I look at how the trend has been with the development of our marijuana reforms, and how as we've lost sight of what the real purpose is, which is stop putting people in a cage for a plant, whether people make money or not, stop putting people in a cage for a plant. We get away from that and we see all sorts of strange things happen. Look at the development of medical marijuana. I look at it in four phases, right? You ever see that map they put on where they got the medical marijuana states? They're all like 29 green states up there. No, there should be four different shades of the medical marijuana states, because you can't tell me California medical is like Minnesota medical. They might as well be two completely different worlds. Here's your four phases. We start out in 1996. California passes the Compassionate Use Act, passes a medical marijuana law that says, hey, look, Your doctor says you need weed, grow it and use it. That was it. There was no condition list. There was no limits. Hey, you need some weed, grow some and use it. We're fine. But then we get to the second phase. From 1998 to 2008, in that decade, we had 8 more states pass medical marijuana. None of them did it like California. They all said, wait a minute. Any condition a doctor says will benefit? Oh, no, no, no. We got to have condition lists. We got to have a checklist to make sure doctors aren't just giving weed to just anybody. Why, a healthy person might be smoking it. So we had these 8 states that came up with condition lists, getting the government in between the doctor and the patient. I always loved how conservatives griped about that when it came to public health care, but when it came to medical marijuana, oh no, let's get that government in there. After 2008, we had another phase. From 2010 to 2013, we had 8 more states pass medical marijuana. None of them allow all patients to home grow. That was the next phase. They took home growing away from the patients. Why, we can't have you growing cannabis plants. Why, you might sell them or give them to someone who's healthy. So they came up with a dispensary system. You have to go to the dispensary. Now, there's a couple exceptions. Arizona says you can home grow plants so long as you live more than 25 miles away from a dispensary. Why? Because if I'm 26 miles away, it's good, but if I'm 24, I'm a criminal? No, it's because they want to, and they literally said this during the campaign. I was there, and I recorded the campaign guy saying, we made a 25-mile halo for the dispensaries to ensure that they would have a market. You know, because selling pot is such a risky business. So many people go out of business. Oh, we got a guarantee. Sure. That 25-mile halo has effectively made it so Arizonans cannot home grow their own medical cannabis. 97% of the population of Arizona lives within 25 miles of a dispensary. They did the same kind of thing in Massachusetts. They said you had to have a hardship exemption. If you could show that it was too difficult for you to go to the dispensary and buy your weed, then we'll let you grow. And this has expanded. They've expanded this. Nevada was one of those states in the first wave that passed medical marijuana that allowed people to grow, home grow. They took that away in 2013. They said, we're going to put a 25-mile halo up in Nevada. So people who had been home growing lost their rights. So we went from wide open California to, okay, you can home grow, but you got to have a specific condition. And then we went to, okay, no, you can't home grow and you have to have a specific condition. And now, 2014 to 2016, the fourth phase, we've got 9 more states that have passed medical marijuana. All of them are no home grow states, and 4 of them, no marijuana. We have 4 states in America that passed medical marijuana where you cannot have marijuana. Now, we'll let you have a tincture or an oil or an edible, but no buds for smoking because smoking is evil. Well, who says? The doctor? No, some bureaucrats, some lawmakers are saying this. So what we've seen in medical marijuana, again, looking at the history, is the government ratcheting down and tightening the restrictions on that in an effort to keep that control and keep that artificial scarcity to the marijuana. And I'm afraid we might see something similar in the recreational movement. Now, so far, so good. 8 states passed recreational legalization, and only 2 of them, well, 8 states in D.C., and only 2 of them really messed it up. Washington State messed it up because they don't let anyone home grow, but they do have pot shops. Washington, D.C. messed it up because they let them home grow, but they can't have pot shops. So in one Washington, a shop is okay, but a home grow is not. In the other Washington, a home grow is okay, but a shop is not. Why? Well, political realities. And this is playing out in 2016, too. Vermont, which passed a legislative legalization that the governor just vetoed, Vermont passed theirs. No shops, but you can home grow. New Jersey's looking at legalization. No home grow, but you can have shops. So the trends, to me, seem to be these trends toward continuing this artificial restriction on cannabis in the name of maintaining profits, maintaining tax revenues. Speaking of profits and tax revenues, another interesting thing I've learned in my studies of this policy, medical marijuana licensing. Oregon's done it pretty well. A few states have done it okay. But lately, the states that have passed medical marijuana have done so in a way that shows you it is all about a money grab. Since 2010, and not counting Arizona, because Arizona has some special circumstances I'm not going to get into this quickly, but since 2010, the average number of medical marijuana producers, growers, the average number of licenses in the 15 states that have passed medical marijuana since 2010 is 7.5. 7.5 growers for your state. Some states are 2, some states are 3, some states are 12, some states are 6, but the average, 7.5 growers for an entire state. Again, artificial restriction, artificial scarcity to maintain that high price. Now, in these 15 states, most of them have a process by which you apply to become a grower. And they issue what are called a non-refundable application fee, or a partially refundable. Like, it's going to cost you $10,000 to turn your paper in, and if we reject you, you don't get your money back. We keep the 10 grand. Because, I did the research on this, I figured out how many people applied in every state versus how many licenses were granted in every state, and did the math. Those 15 states have raked in $10 million just from taking a piece of paper and saying no. $10 million. Then, take a look at what the annual costs are to run one of these production facilities. After you've applied your non-refundable application fee, if you did get accepted, you then have to demonstrate $500,000, $1 million, $2 million in accessible capital. You have to be able to show your surety bonds up in the $1 million range. And then you have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars of annual fees on top of that. The average in those 15 states that have passed since 2010, the average you would spend each year, not counting the bonds and stuff, just what you'd spend, $900,000. That doesn't sound like freeing the plant to me. That doesn't sound like helping patients to me. That sounds like getting some people rich to me. And the reason that bothers me so much is because I and a lot of people who've been in this movement for over a decade aren't in here to get people rich. I didn't care who was getting rich when I was buying a bag in the parking lot of Walgreens. I don't care who's getting rich now when I'm buying at a dispensary. What I do care about is stopping the arrest and imprisonment and harassment and ruining of the lives of people who use and consume cannabis, period. I don't care if it costs us more money. I don't care if we lose money. It's wrong to lock people up for a plant, and that's why we should be doing what we are doing. I'm not in this for money. I'm in this because the Ninth Amendment says we have the right to cannabis, and nobody has the right to take that away from us. We've had our heritage stolen from us in this country. The first hemp plantation in this country was 1611 in the Jonestown colony. We've had hemp for over 4 centuries on this continent. Medical marijuana got its revival in 1850 with Dr. O'Shaughnessy. We've had medical marijuana in this country since 1850. In fact, it was in the U.S. Pharmacopeia for 90 years. It's only been prohibited for 80. It was medicine longer than it was prohibited. And we've had recreational cannabis since 1900. If you look back to King Oliver and Louis Armstrong and Cab Calloway singing about the reefer man and jive. So that's our culture. And our culture's been taken from us, stolen from us, by what was originally timber companies and paper companies, what is now oil companies and pharmaceutical companies. But it's been taken from us in the name of profit. So, in closing, I just want to remind you about that story of aluminum and how a very precious and wonderful commodity that was artificially scarce became very plentiful and very cheap in a very short time. And to remember that that all-consuming search for profit is going to doom this movement if we don't recall why we're in this. And it's not about who gets rich. It's about not locking people up and ruining their lives over a plant. It's our right. It's our heritage. And we need to reclaim it. I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me. Have yourselves a great PDX Hemp Fest. And check me out at mjagenda.com. If you need a card to remember that, I've got some cards right here. Thank you so much.